Owing to illness that has wiped out everyone in our house, we are dipping into the B-sides, our rejection pile.
Of the Lit from the Basement album, if you want to think of it that way.
This is an unaired episode from October of 2018.
For your listening pleasure. Welcome to Lit from the Basement. This is Danielle.
And this is Max.
I'm an author and professor.
I'm a former scruffy-looking Nerf herder, now stay-at-home dad.
We're a married couple who discuss literature in our basement while our children are sleeping. Our show is pretty simple. I introduce Max to a poem or a short piece of prose. We discuss it a bit, use it as a springboard to discuss issues that we're passionate about or personal stories from our lives.
And the boys are now asleep.
So let's talk.
So here we are at show number 13, which we're recording out of order and very early, but happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. That will at least be celebrated later this week. So this is a story that I've chosen specifically for this holiday. Not because it's necessarily spooky.
Gruesome?
Psychologically gruesome, but perhaps
okay,
not.
I'm still with that.
Not necessarily physically. Well, it takes place near Halloween.
Okay.
But I see it as a kind of way of orienting the reader to some of the foundational fears of Halloween.
Mm-hmm. Not getting enough candy, getting rocks like Charlie Brown did.
Yes, the most horrible of all.
These are primal fears.
No, of dying, of course.
Oh.
Yeah.
Those of you who plan that, it could be scary.
Who plan to die.
Yeah.
Right. I know that you will be immortal, which is going to be unfortunate for me because I will probably pass away since I do not believe I myself am immortal.
Well, that's what's going to cause it.
So if I just believe in it, it will happen?
The death or your immortality?
My immortality.
Well, I think the secret is to be so cocksure that other people begin to wonder if it's a possibility.
Okay.
And that'll lead to stories of you, which leads to immortality.
Okay, immortality through storytelling. That's not the kind I was talking about.
Okay.
So the other reason that I chose this, that I was interested in this, is that it's a close look at a relationship in a very domestic space, a very domestic and mundane space.
In the form of this, you said this is not a poem you're giving me today.
No, it's not.
Okay.
Oh, I forgot to mention this. Yes, this is prose.
Prose. Okay.
So this is a piece of flash fiction. For those of you who don't know.
Yeah, I was about to ask, flash like it's stylish and gone? I've heard it, but I've heard it thrown around. It's a coffee shop term.
It's not a coffee shop term.
Okay.
No, it's an actual thing. Usually flash is thought of as 1,000 words or less.
Oh, okay.
The shorter it is, the sort of more people.
Flashier it is?
No, the different names there is. There's microfiction, which is considerably smaller. I think it considered 100 words or less.
What does for sale baby shoes
never worn
count as?
Oh, I mean, that's the original flash fiction.
Right?
Yeah, that's the Hemingway quote-unquote short story.
He had that was a bet he made with somebody, right? Or
I don't
know.
That
they can make the saddest, shortest story.
I forget. I don't know. I don't
sure
know the story
everybody
behind
listening
that
knows that. We should. Okay.
Just sitting over here sounding like jackasses. We can recite that 6-word flash fiction piece by Hemingway like everyone can. No, so this is a piece of flash fiction. And usually in flash pieces, fiction or essays, I tend to like things that are kind of weird in their structure.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true of this particular piece. It's really it uses a traditional narrative structure. And I can talk about that a little bit more later on. But one of the things I really admire about this piece is how tight it is within that narrative structure. I think it's really doing a lot with very little, which is exactly what you want a flash fiction piece to do.
Okay.
And there is a love story in here.
In here. in the many folds and layers of this?
No, it's pretty apparent. I mean, it's about a husband and wife.
Okay.
Who in it, as you will see, it starts
move
with
into a haunted motel.
No, that would have been a great one for Flash Fiction. For those of you who have like excellent Halloween stories, please contact us, email us to let me know. I can, at the very least, I can save them up for next year.
Okay.
No, it starts in a very mundane way. It's just a husband and wife carving pumpkins on their porch.
Are the pumpkins screaming? Well, I guess we'll know.
We'll know in right now. I mean, should we talk about when we moved into our haunted house here?
This,
rather than read this right now?
Well, wait, what? Okay.
Back earlier, I just realized you mentioned, like, dude, there's a couple moving to a haunted motel, and we could do a segue into us moving into this place and us both being creeped out.
Well, we were both creeped out, but it wasn't. Well, here we
go. What about the boys?
Okay.
Seeing the thing.
Okay. I have to tread carefully because as an atheist, obviously, I cannot and do not believe in spirits.
Right?
And yet what I came to accept was I can believe in string theory and maybe parallel universes, and sometimes there's a weakness between them. Or there's some kind of residue and something as humans that we don't know that we write off as otherworldly. It's just beyond our understanding.
That sounds an awful lot like spirits to me.
I'll talk about the boys and what they saw or their reaction and my immediate reaction to that. You go ahead and go the route you want to go.
What do you mean? What route do I want to go?
Well, you already threw out the word ghost.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that ghost. Now, you cannot tell me that you weren't totally creeped out when we first moved into this house.
I was unsettled. I was not creeped. I was unsettled. There were things.
You had a strong sensation that somebody was watching you.
And peripheral hallucinations.
Right.
Which I do have a history of drug abuse. So let's lay the scientific facts down for whatever it was that we encountered in this house.
But we moved in, and
technically we're the third owners of this house, or you are. You're the third owner of this house. Really, the people that are here before us were here for less than a year.
And the person
that was a warning light, I guess.
Yeah. I know. I almost thought about like emailing them or something to be like, so did you leave because the house is haunted?
So because we had the woman whose house this was before them was a widower and a child loss.
A widow.
What do we call? Yeah, sorry, a widow. What do we call a woman? We still don't have the word for a person who's lost their children.
No, there's not a word for that. I think it's too painful of a word for people to sort of comprehend. Her parents
owned all the property around here.
And built this house
for her and her husband. They had a child.
And then
the child passed.
The child died when he was about 10 or 11 in a house fire.
What?
Not in this house.
Okay.
But in a house fire. Yeah, I learned that from...
our neighbor?
I learned that from Gary.
I did not hear that part.
Yeah.
Wow.
But she never had any other children and she never wed again. And the house was basically untouched from when it was
created. It was like it was hermetically sealed.
Yeah.
It was, this house has been untouched. The electricity, nothing had been updated since 1957 when it was created.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
And we've had to do a lot.
We'll make it safe to plug in a computer.
Right. Just to make it contemporary and livable.
Yeah.
And so we moved into the house. And of course, you know, a brand new house, you're getting used to all kinds of like smells and sights and sounds. Mm-hmm. Right. So there, you know, there's a good explanation in that. But I just had the strangest feeling that I was being watched. Not just that I was being watched, but that I was being judged.
Assessed.
Yeah. I was being assessed. And for me, it was a distinctly feminine presence.
Mm-hmm. Mine was masculine.
And his was masculine. Oddly, and this is sort of weird, I felt like anytime I was doing something that required physical attention, such as breastfeeding my son or going to the bathroom, the presence went away. Like I had this feeling,
respectful.
That it was just kind of prudish. Like it was a prudish ghost who was oh my, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to follow you there. I'll not haunt you while you take a dump.
Okay. That's what drove it away. Our hedonistic exposure life. We chase the spirits out. Hedonistic pleasures thrashing about.
Yeah, that's what our life is like with two very small children. Yeah. It's just hedonism all the time. But that's not really the creepiest part. I mean, I did hear the piano playing one night. Mm-hmm. In the middle of the night.
It was somebody like testing the keys. Yes, that's what was weird. Like,
yes,
bing,
test,
bing,
ding,
bing, bing. Oh, this
ding,
is the sound it makes.
Ding. Yeah, like what, how and why and what.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was super, super creepy. And
I was, Danielle was immediately vocal. I'm
more hesitant.
Hesitant to discuss or admit. At first, I want to
rationalize it in some way.
Yes.
I mean, literally, to make it make sense.
Right.
Some explainable way.
Right. I think the first thing I confided in you, you were talking about you felt like you were being observed.
Yeah.
By an older woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that there was a guy in a red and black plaid shirt that I keep spotting in the corner of my eye.
Right. An older dude.
Yeah, an older man who was just assessing, and then I turned fully, not there. I wasn't creeped out by it. I was getting very frustrated and starting to doubt myself.
Right.
Like, should I be left alone with my kids if I'm seeing people in the house?
Oh, interesting. Right.
Right.
I think that's a valid question.
Right.
Right, but you didn't actually see anybody because you'd turn your head and then nothing would be there.
Right.
I did briefly, in considering what was going on in our house and just the general sense of creepiness that we had here, I thought for a moment, I wondered if these weren't ghosts from the past, but that if we had gotten stuck, and I know this is probably scientifically completely impossible.
I will already say, I think I know where you're going, and I'll take that more.
That actually it was
echoes
us.
Of us.
Yeah.
Okay.
That it was us from the future somehow echoing back.
I don't know why, but maybe now. I don't know why I'd wear a red and black Pendleton flannel, but okay.
But maybe you would 40 years from now.
Now wearing it. Oregon broke me. Okay, here I go.
All right, red and black flannel. If you can't beat them. But... that none of this actually approximates the incredible creepiness that was surrounding our children.
Right.
When we moved in.
Yes.
And that was the part that was truly unsettling.
That's the part that pushed me to be vocal and start asking people, like our neighbors, question, like
about like, did somebody die in this house?
Right.
What
happened? Well, if you have, I have the story. Do you have a different one?
Yeah. I mean, this is what creepy, you know. We were down in the rumpus room,
mm-hmm.
and Mercer looked up at the stairs and said, "Mama, Mama!" And I'm like, "I'm sitting right here." He said, "Come back, Mama!" and started running toward the stairs to follow somebody who was not there.
Hmm.
And Miles also got up and was like, "Mama, Mama!" and started running. I was like, "What are you talking about? I'm literally sitting right here." That not only did they see something, both of them, and follow whatever
now,
it was.
Now, was Miles
but they
just
did
picking
it in,
up from...
It's possible that Miles was just picking up what Mercer was doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're only a year and 9 months apart.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're fairly attuned to one another. But, I just got full body goosebumps,
mm-hmm.
and was like, what are you even talking about? And he sort of stood and he like shook his head and he kept looking at the space where... he seemed to be looking before and he sort of shook his head and I was like, what's happening? And I'm right here. He said, oh, she went away and then went back and sat. I mean, they were watching television
right
when it happened. So what was so visually stimulating that it would take their minds away from the television. It's almost impossible for us to talk to them when they are watching
this
TV.
This evening, I was like snapping my fingers in front of his face going, Mercer, do you have to go to the bathroom?
Do you have to go to the bathroom?
He's slack-jawed staring at the TV.
Right, exactly. So that part creeped me out. And then, for the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Danielle and Max. The flash fiction piece we're discussing today is Yours by Mary Robinson. If you'd like to read along with the work, you can find it on our website, litfromthebasement.com. Go to the show notes tab and find show number 49.
You were at work, I believe.
Yes, I was at work because you called me to make sure that I was not dead.
Yeah. Okay, you're totally obliterating my atheist cred. But I had made dinner for the boys. The three of us were sitting at the table, and they both stopped in mid-bite to look behind me into the living room.
Both of them at
us.
Once.
Yeah, both of them at once. And then I looked over my shoulder and I thought, well, maybe there's somebody standing out front of our front. We have bay windows. And I thought, okay, well, there's somebody standing there waiting to get in. Maybe they're trying to wave and get our attention. They don't want to knock on the door. I don't know. I looked back. I didn't see anything. And I looked back at them and they're both blank faced looking, but they're tracking
something.
They are both, their eyes and heads are slowly moving
at the same pace.
Yeah. And I'm looking back and looking at them. And I started immediately getting overly creeped.
Yeah.
And I barked at them, what are you looking at? And they kept, and then Miles.
Dad of the year.
Because what is it they're seeing?
Because
now they're looking over at the fireplace. Whatever it was has moved across or whatever they.
Across the room.
And it's down to the far side and they're both looking. And I bark at them, what are you looking at? And then I look at them, look over my shoulder, look back at them. And they both give kind of like a playful smile.
Uh-huh.
And then they go back to eating. Like, not a playful smile to me. A playful smile to something
to past the thing
me.
That was there.
Right. Whatever they both were tracking.
Didn't they say again, mama?
Oh, that's right.
That's why you called me.
That's
what I remember. I was sitting in my office and I got a call from you and you were like, oh, okay. So you're fine? Everything's fine? Yeah. I'm like, yeah, what's going on?
I'm like, I'm afraid that you died and suddenly you appeared before the boys.
Yeah, to say goodbye to them before I left.
Yeah. Again, don't believe in spirits. Don't believe in an afterlife. Don't believe in souls trapped in purgatory. String theory, vibrations of another universe came a little close. Maybe parallel universe you tried to break through, like Tholian web, that Star Trek episode. I'll take that as more science fictiony, as opposed to horror. So is this what the story you're going to show us?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's just that when you asked about the story, you said, I said a couple, and you said they moved into
a haunted hotel. Yeah, okay.
I was like, well, I mean, you know, or we could talk about us moving into our haunted house.
Okay. But, I remember because you were even talking to colleagues about it, and I'm like, please don't do that. Don't tell people we believe we live in a haunted house.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I only told a very select colleagues, the colleagues that I thought would not judge me too severely for being anti-intellectual.
Yeah, because that pretty much is anti-intellectual.
Right, it is anti-intellectual. So, you know, I only told the people, you know, and I gave all kinds of disclaimers. Like, I am not saying that I believe in ghosts, but...
This being said, nothing, right?
Nothing has happened since.
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. No. Yeah.
Whatever the weirdness was,
it seems to have
whatever
gone.
Whatever alignments had happened, they're now disaligned. Whatever.
Maybe we put enough of our vibes in the house, which is also a very intellectual thing to say.
It's a very Californian thing to say.
It is a very Californian thing to say. It's a very West Coast generally thing to say. Oregonians use vibe as well.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, let's get to the story in which... No ghosts appear. Yours by Mary Robinson. Allison struggled away from her white Renault, limping with the weight of the last of the pumpkins. She found Clark in the twilight on the twig and leaf littered porch behind the house. He wore a wool shawl. He was moving up and back in a paddled glider, pushing by the ball of his slippered foot. Allison lowered a big pumpkin, let it rest on the wide floorboards. Clark was much older, 78 to Allison's 35. They were married. They were both quite tall and looked something alike in their facial features. Allison wore a natural hair wig. It was a thick blonde hood around her face. She was dressed in bright dyed denims today. She wore durable clothes, usually, for she volunteered afternoons at a children's daycare center. She put one of the smaller pumpkins on Clark's long lap. "Now, nothing surreal," she told him. "Carve just a regular face. These are for the kids." In the foyer, on the hippo-white desk, Allison found the maid's chore list with its cross-offs, which included Clark's supper. Allison went quickly through the Daily Mail, a garish coupon packet, a bill from Jamestown Liquors, November's pay TV program guide, and the worst thing, the funniest, an already opened, extremely unkind letter from Clark's relations up north. "You're an old fool," Allison read, "and you're being cruelly deceived." There was a gift check for Clark enclosed, but it was uncashable, signed as it was, Jesus H. Christ. Late into this night, Allison and Clark gutted and carved the pumpkins together at an old table set on the back porch, over newspaper after soggy newspaper with paring knives and with spoons and with a Swiss Army knife Clark used for exact shaping of tooth and eye and nostril. Clark had been a doctor, an internist, but also a Sunday watercolorist. His four pumpkins were expressive and artful. Their carved features were suited to the sizes and shapes of the pumpkins. Two looked ferocious and jagged. One registered surprise. The last was serene and beaming. Allison's four faces were less deftly drawn, with slits and areas of distortion. She had cut triangles for noses and eyes. The mouths she had made were just wedges, two turned up and two turned down. By 1 a.m, they were finished. Clark, who had bent his long torso forward to work, moved back over to the glider and looked out sleepily at nothing. All the lights were out across the ravine. Clark stayed. For the season and time, the Virginia night was warm. Most leaves had been blown away already, and the trees stood unbothered. The moon was round above them. Allison cleaned up the mess. "Your jack-o'-lanterns are much, much better than mine," Clark said to her. "Like hell," Allison said. "Look at me," Clark said. Allison did. She was holding a squishy bundle of newspapers. The papers reeked sweetly with the smell of pumpkin guts. "Yours are far better," he said. "You're wrong. You'll see when they're lit," Allison said. She went inside and came back with yellow vigil candles. It took her a while to get each candle settled, and then to line up the results in a row on the porch railing. She went along and lit each candle and fixed the pumpkin lids over the little flames. "See," she said. They sat together a moment and looked at the orange faces. "We're exhausted. It's good night time," Allison said. "Don't blow out the candles. I'll put new ones in tomorrow." That night, in their bedroom, a few weeks earlier than had been predicted, Allison began to die. "Don't look at me if my wig comes off," she told Clark. "Please." Her pulse cords were fluttering under his fingers. She raised her knees and kicked away the comforter. She said something to Clark about the garage being locked. At the telephone, Clark had a clear view out back and down to the porch. He wanted to get drunk with his wife once more. He wanted to tell her, from the greater perspective he had, that to own only a little talent, like his, was an awful, plaguing thing. That being only a little special meant you expected too much most of the time and liked yourself too little. He wanted to assure her that she had missed nothing. He was speaking into the phone now. He watched the jack-o'-lanterns. The jack-o'-lanterns watched him. I think it's really apparent at the beginning that this story is set at a particular time of year, right? And I think it's very clear by the end that that description of the setting is not a mere backdrop to the things that are happening. But to have the ending moment land on those jack-o'-lanterns, I think is quite telling to the way in which the description of the landscape is telling you something greater about the psychological landscape of the characters.
Okay.
That's one of the
ellipses.
That's one of the reasons why I love this piece. Well, we start, of course, with them in sitting on the porch carving pumpkins.
Or her coming upon him sitting on the back porch, and you think he's going to be infirm. He wore a wool shawl. He's rocking back and forth on a glider on the back porch amongst twigs and leaves, so all the plants have died. That's how we meet him, and then...
Well, we meet her right when she's limping with the weight of the last of the pumpkins. So the last of the pumpkins, of course, suggests that there has been a huge haul of pumpkins that she's mm-hmm. bringing from the trunk of her car and bringing them up to the porch. And it's funny that you see him as infirm. I think him wearing a wool shawl means that it's just cool out, because we don't know how old he is at this point.
But a man wrapped in a blanket, not a guy sitting in a jacket.
Okay, I see.
It's this is when I'm sitting on the back porch with a shawl wrapped around me.
You're right. Okay, fair enough. I can't picture
that. We'll give it 2 more years. I do have a few years on you.
You do have a few years on me. That's
and
true.
And those are city miles.
I know. I see what you're saying. All right. So you're expecting that he is the one who is perhaps ill.
Right.
At the beginning.
This is a May-December relationship.
Perhaps. Yes. And that's what we're given in the next few lines, right? So she's got a task at hand. She's lowering a bunch of pumpkins onto the porch,
mm-hmm.
right? And then we're just given straight out, Clark was much older, 78 to Allison's 35. Now, I think that it's just given in that really flat way as, you know, just a moment of really direct exposition because it incites all kinds of questions for the reader.
Like, let's not dance around this.
Yeah. But also, you know, it almost invites you to make judgments about their relationship without an actual invitation. She's just saying, he's 78, she's 35. What do you think about that?
Right. But then 2 sentences later, mm-hmm. Allison wore a natural hair wig.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which I think the first time I read this, I of course stopped that. I'm like, she's 35, but she's wearing a natural hair wig. Is she sick? But then also it's Halloween. So I'm wondering if she's just being wacky.
Oh God, that didn't even, you're right.
Right? She has pumpkins in her hands. She's setting them out and I'm like, what is that? But of course she has to tell us that straight out. She's wearing a natural hair wig. You're like, why?
Oh, see, I jumped right to,
Cancer?
Yes.
Oh, interesting. I don't think that I did the very first time that I read this, but I could be wrong. Perhaps I did. It's hard to tell since I've read this so many times. So he's 78 to her 35. She has this natural hair wig, which we do come to understand is cancer related, that she's trying to cover perhaps hair loss from various remedies for her condition.
For the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Daniela Max. The flash fiction we're discussing today is Yours by Mary Robison. If you'd like to read along with the work, you can find it on our website, litfromthebasement.com. Go to the show notes tab and find show number 49.
But I think it's interesting that they're both tall and look a little bit of alike in their facial features.
Right. So was that a red herring? Because I'm like, okay, what's this then? On top of the non-traditional relationship, but it seems to just be a red herring.
You can consider a number of things there. One is that it's generally thought that people, when they're together for a long time or that they have a close relationship, that they sort of begin to look alike. There's that. There's also this way in which the people that you fall in love with tend to be familiar to you in some way. And sometimes that's actually that they look like somewhat like your family.
Oh, okay.
That they actually are alike in some way.
Mm-hmm.
That they're kindred spirits at the very least. And that perhaps the way in which they look alike has something to do with their facial expressions.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're in love and there's that sort of transformative experience and somebody else's psyche becomes well known to you,
mm-hmm.
That you begin in this sort of behavior loop expressing similar gestures to one another.
Mm-hmm.
This happens a lot, of course, in close relationships and also even in friendships, where you forget who's saying or whose gesture it was to begin with, because mm-hmm. you both share it.
Yeah.
You both do it so often that you can't remember where it started.
That's why I never buy the sci-fi trope of the doppelganger or the shapeshifter fitting in.
Oh, yeah.
You would know in 5 minutes.
Yeah, that something was really wrong with you.
Right.
Right? I'd be like, what is up?
And why does he keep drinking all that kerosene?
Yeah, you're right. That there would be a strangeness in behavior. They wouldn't be inside of the established social loops, mm-hmm. right?
I wouldn't know the shorthand. I wouldn't know the little winks and the body postures we have just a way of communicating.
Yeah,
with
they'd
one
have
another.
To speak in entirely in terrible exposition in the way that bad dialogue works in movies and films. Like, hello there.
Hello, wife.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me set down this briefcase. That's curious. He doesn't have a job. He stays at home with the kids normally.
As you know, I love you and our darling children.
Where are they?
Yes. So I just see that as a way of quickly describing that they sort of look alike. They're both tall.
Well, the fact is that she never had a good relationship with her father. Maybe he passed when she was very young, and all she has is vague memories and photos of him, and this guy looks vaguely like that.
That would be the cynical view of this, and I think that you can go ahead and say yes.
I've dated 3 women that way.
Are you serious?
2. That I'm certain of.
That you're certain
that
of.
That admitted it to me.
That it was a daddy thing.
Yeah. Which I don't know how much it says about me, because I continued to date after that.
It says a lot, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, yeah, I'm all right with that. You still like me, right?
Past
yeah, okay.
Tense was all right.
Fair enough. Okay, so Allison puts one of the smaller pumpkins on Lark's long lap.
Mm-hmm.
She says, nothing surreal. Carved just a regular face. These are for the kids. So they're doing this chore together. We see that they're working together for some children who have not been named, right? Mm-hmm. These are for the kids. And they don't seem to have any children of their own.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing this volunteer work together, which if we were to take the bait of the beginning and think that, say, Clark was somehow wealthy and Allison married him for his wealth.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't the thing that we would imagine them doing together. Like,
right.
We're going to volunteer together and carve pumpkins together for children. That seems like a very sincere activity
mm-hmm.
that two people who care about each other and care about other people would do together, right? We see that she's wearing, like, denim. She's got this natural hair wig. There's nothing about her that seems fancy or that she's taking advantage of the
right.
situation at all. She's not doused in jewels. She's not in pumps. She's like, what I'm going to do with this time is carve pumpkins for the children.
And light admonishment to my husband to not get too artistic.
Yes, right? Like, she is the pragmatic one between the two of them, which is interesting because it tells us later that he is a doctor, right?
Yeah.
So, and then we get the scene when she finds the letter, of course, from his relations up north.
On a hippo white desk.
Yes, which means what?
Well, I couldn't spot a hippo white desk, but a hippo white chair has the backing of it is shaped like a shield.
Oh,
that's
interesting.
What I know. The guy who did it, he was a British, English, whatever, UK. I don't know if it was United Kingdom back then. Yeah, it was. Wasn't it? In the 1700s? I'm an American. I have no concept of other countries. Whatever. It's the guy who created a style. I don't know what hippo white desks are. I know hippo white chairs have a shield back. And I remember the gamer geek in me really thinks that looks cool. That's the only ways and only reason why
really?
What a hippo white chair is. I don't know what hippo white desk looks like.
Well, so Allison finds the maid's chore list with its cross-offs.
And a bill from Jamestown Liquor.
A bill from Jamestown Liquors. And it does tell us later that he wanted to get drunk with his wife once more, right? So this
again,
is
again something fun to do when you don't have kids.
Yeah,
I mean,
for sure.
We used to drink.
We used to love it.
That was fun.
I know. I loved drinking with you. That was super fun. She gets this unkind letter from Clark's relations up north, and then a gift check from Jesus H. Christ.
So does he have old money up north?
That's what it seems
there's
like.
There's a lot of questions there. Are they his children?
Possibly, right? He's old enough, and there's no mention of that this is his children. I mean, it might just be brothers or sisters or...
Right, relations. I think that if they were actually kids, that she would have had a little bit of, like, respect, but understanding why they might be agitated that their dad is dating somebody
right. I mean,
younger
this is,
than them.
This is in third person, right? So what we get here is what the narrator wants to tell us, and it feels like the narrator's been really straightforward with us so far, so that if the relations actually were children, she might have just said children.
You're right. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Okay.
So relations does suggest somebody different, a cousin or a brother or something, right?
Somebody from, but I still get the sensation that somebody from a shared money.
Possibly, yeah.
To where they could jokingly and cruelly send fake checks.
Right. And have time to do it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there it is. They have the time to do it. Yes, they have money. You're right.
Yeah, the time and the inclination to do this. So, you know, this is a comment on, of course, their relationship, right? He's being cruelly deceived by this young woman whom he married. Clearly, she can't possibly love you, right? But then we see late into the night, Allison and Clark gutted and carved the pumpkins together. This is not like just one task. They're carving all the pumpkins.
Right.
For all the kids. Yeah. So we assume that this is a group of children that whom they are doing this for, a kind of volunteer thing, right?
Yeah, because she unloaded the last pumpkin at twilight. Mm-hmm. Now it's 1 a.m.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
that's a lot of pumpkin carving.
So twilight in October in Virginia.
Yeah.
What are we looking at? 6 o'clock?
Yeah. It's quite possible that this isn't at all for a volunteer sort of situation. It's possible that they're just carving pumpkins to line up their...
For
kids visiting their house for Halloween. They're doing this activity together. Which is somewhat laborious and not luxurious in any way, right? They're carving pumpkins together. They like spending time together.
Right.
They like each other.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I get from this. Mm-hmm. Like, how happy would you and I be carving pumpkins on a porch together? Like, I think that we'd be pretty pleased with ourselves.
Yeah.
Like, we would keep each other company really well.
Yeah.
And I would probably have to say to you, nothing too surreal.
Or no, you'd actually say nothing too gruesome.
Yeah, nothing too gruesome. This is for the kids.
By the way, in Cincinnati, before we had kids, those kids walking up and trick-or-treating complimented my pumpkin.
I know, but it was gruesome. They were like, wow, what is that?
That is awesome, kids. Thank you for settling an argument.
I have no visual talents. I'll just say that. But so, you know.
And I have a little talent. Just enough to really identify with this man.
Really? At the end? Allison's were less deftly drawn, we're told. And we
upside down triangles.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, I like the classic pumpkin. I have to say, I agree with Allison in this way. Just give me a happy, happy smiley face pumpkin. You know, they stay up till one carving these pumpkins. Hers aren't as cool as his.
She says specifically, when it's time to be done, I underline this, don't blow out the candles. I'll put new ones in tomorrow.
Yeah. What about that?
Well, the last line.
Yeah.
He's looking at the flickering light of these. That's yes. her. That's her departure when these candles blow out.
Yeah. That's totally what's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, right after that, right after this moment where she says, I'll put them in tomorrow, he says, your jack-o'-lanterns are much, much better than mine
mm-hmm.
to her. Why? Why would he do this? And she says, like hell. And he says, look at me. Yours are far better. What's happening in that moment, do you think, psychologically?
That to own only a little talent like his was an awful, plaguing thing. That being only a little special meant you expected too much most of the time and liked yourself too little.
He wanted to assure her that she had missed nothing.
Yeah. It was, you've seen Amadeus.
Oh, yeah. That was my favorite movie when I was a little girl.
Salieri's Curse. He had just enough talent to see the genius of Amadeus.
Oh, that is a curse.
I've got just enough talent to know how much I suck. To really comprehend
the limitations of my talent.
Yeah, I have just enough talent to go, oh, fuck me. I think that's what he's saying. He's like, you know what? Your shit is good where you are.
I mean, is he just lying there because he sees that she's frail? I mean, that's one of my questions about this moment. Is he actually really saying, like, yours are better than mine. Yours are better than mine because they're pragmatic. Like, they get the job done.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you don't sit there fumbling around being like, oh, I'm going to make these more beautiful.
I'm going to make these for kids who? Remember these pumpkins.
Exactly. For no. who? For the children who will look at them once and not. Yeah. Whereas Allison's like, these are for the kids. They're straightforward. They're simple. You know, that they get the job done. Probably better, and she doesn't have any sort of ego tied up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps, like, that's his message here. Like, yours are better because they do what they're supposed to do. But she says you're wrong. You'll see when they're lit. Like, she's a pragmatist throughout.
Mm-hmm.
She's carrying the pumpkins up. She's carving the pumpkins. She's like hell. She's like, you're wrong. And she. She went along and lit each candle and fixed the pumpkin lids over the little flame. See, she said. They sat down together a moment and looked at the orange faces. And then she says, sort of like as a group statement, we're exhausted. It's good night time, which is a little bit playful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, let's go, you know, don't blow out the candles. I'll put new ones in tomorrow.
Yeah.
He said. And then it's this very straightforward exposition again. That night in their bedroom, a few weeks earlier than had been predicted, Allison began to die. Don't look at me if my wig comes off, she told Clark, please. And I really love that moment because it's the only moment that she's been frivolous
mm-hmm.
about her looks.
Yeah. She has a vanity that she didn't have before, wearing colored denims.
Right.
You get the impression of low maintenance.
Low maintenance, but she does wear that wig, right?
Yeah.
She doesn't want her husband to see her in what she perceives is ugly.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't want her wig to come off. She doesn't want her husband to perceive her as being sickly. And that little bit of vanity, I think, shows a certain amount of affection for him
mm-hmm.
as well. Like, that he's still the person whom she wants to see her as beautiful. Or healthy, at the very least, right? Don't look at me if my wig comes off. It's the only time she's said anything that would go against the rest of her character, which is very straightforward mm-hmm. and pragmatic. Her pulse cords were fluttering under his fingers. She raised her knees and kicked away the comforter. She said something to Clark about the garage being locked.
Yeah, so she's in delirium. She's got a fever happening, or...
Right. But even in that fever, she's trying to take care of things. She says something to Clark about the garage being locked. Like, she's still thinking about their house and how to manage things and what needs to be done, right? She's a worker.
For the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Danielle and Max. The flash fiction piece we're discussing today is Yours by Mary Robinson. If you'd like to read along with the work, you can find it on our website, litfromthebasement.com. Go to the show notes tab and find show number 49.
And then you get this passage that I love and is also terrible.
Yeah.
It's emotionally, it's terrible. At the telephone. So we understand that he's gone downstairs. He's probably has the phone. He's looking out of the windows and he's probably talking to the doctor, right? Mm-hmm. Or calling an ambulance,
yeah,
or something to that effect. So it's this moment, which I think is beautifully shows in a moment of emotional trauma for mm-hmm. Clark, right? He is talking on the phone. He doesn't want to fully feel or fully realize the extent to which what is happening mm-hmm. is happening. And so you get this slight disconnect in the moment. First of all, he sort of ruminates on himself, mm-hmm. right? And himself in relation to her, that he wanted to get drunk with his wife once more.
Yeah.
Which I love. He wanted to tell her from the greater perspective he'd had that to own only a little talent like his was an awful plaguing thing. You know, he wanted to reassure her that she had missed nothing. And then you get the final last line, just three sentences. The final last paragraph, rather, of three sentences. He was speaking into the phone now. He watched the jack-o'-lanterns. The jack-o'-lanterns watched him. So everything that they had just worked for and carved together on that porch, staring at him. And of course,
the guttering. I mean, I just imagine the guttering candles. Like,
yeah.
this is a little candle. It's going to blow out
any minute.
Yeah, any moment.
Yeah, any minute. They aren't going to last in the morning. By the morning anyway.
And he wanted to assure her she missed nothing. He's like, I'm twice your age. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is very interesting. I hadn't considered thinking about his age at this particular moment. I thought it was kind of a discussion about temperament, like how you perceive yourself in the world and how that may make the time feel terrible mm-hmm. or longer or that sort of thing. He wanted to assure her that she'd missed nothing. She did everything that she could.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But there's also a matter of those jack-o'-lanterns themselves. They are symbols of the end of a harvest.
Mm-hmm.
They are symbols of sort of good spirits, right? Like people carve them in order to guide the good spirits toward the house and,
really?
ward off evil ones.
Ward. Okay.
Yeah, and ward off
exactly,
evil ones.
Like a poor... Poor gargoyles.
Yeah.
Poor people's gargoyles.
Yeah, but there is also a way in which you've taken a living thing and you have gutted it, you've carved it open and taken out all of its innards and then replaced it with a flickering candle. So in a very real and physical sense, they are reanimated corpses in some way, right? That this hollowed out space where the light flickers is supposed to be a kind of physical representation of the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And
within the husk.
Within the husk of the body.
Mm.
And so without drawing attention too much to it, the pumpkins themselves are a symbol of mortality. And I think the idea of mortality or the fear of mortality is at the center of our thinking of these kinds of holidays that celebrate the spirit, that celebrate spirits, ghoulish things, fears.
Well, that's the very, ever since the bubonic plague, Westerners, we have a memento mori. We have a very joyous way of confronting death.
Yeah.
We wear skulls. The more punky metal people do. But I mean, we have a way of appropriating death image to force a familiarity with it. We're not afraid of you. Look, I'm so not afraid of you, death, that I'll wear skulls on me.
Right.
It's a bravado. It's a
yeah.
A bravado.
I mean, I think that our current American way of celebrating Halloween is really a simulacra to the earlier pagan traditions, which are kind of all over the place.
Wait. Did the pagans, were they about dressing as drunk slutty nurse or drunk slutty catwoman?
Slutty spider.
Slutty spider. Slutty grim reaper.
Yeah, that's very traditional. It comes from the
Samhain, Samhain.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's become so bastardized from its original sort of meaning, which actually was a part of pagan rituals.
I think we have a great tradition of doing that. Easter has nothing to do with the Babylon goddess anymore.
Oh no. Yeah, not even remotely. I mean. But there is at the center of our raucous Halloween party. I love a good Halloween party.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a center of that, like a spirit of celebration
mm-hmm.
that did come from the Celtic tradition, which they actually, it was sort of end of the harvest and end of summer when they believed. And this is my very thin knowledge of this. So I need to get,
it's a hard C, by the way.
Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
The Celts believed that at the end of the harvest, that there was a kind of thinning between the barrier of our world and the spirit world.
Yes.
And that allowed sort of magical and ghoulish creatures and spirits to roam.
From the first world.
Right. To roam the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to sort of ward off bad spirits, they had big raucous parties, which seems like a great way to do it. Like, the ghosts wouldn't come if you're making too much noise and having too much fun,
yeah.
Right? Which I love. And they also, carved various vegetables, squashes and turnips and whatnot.
Gourds.
With faces in order to ward off the bad spirits, but also fill them with light in order to light the way to their homes for the good spirits to come. So it was sort of warding off of evil and invitation to good at the same time, right? So I think that at the center of sort of American raucous Halloween parties is a kind of, perhaps a kind of bravado, but I think there's also a sense that they're warding off fear. And I think the central fear is always a fear of mortality.
And before we leave you on this Halloween, here's Danielle reading that story one more time.
Yours by Mary Robison. Allison struggled away from her white Renault, limping with the weight of the last of the pumpkins. She found Clark in the twilight on the twig and leaf littered porch behind the house. He wore a wool shawl. He was moving up and back in a paddled glider, pushing by the ball of his slippered foot. Allison lowered a big pumpkin, let it rest on the wide floorboards. Clark was much older, 78 to Allison's 35. They were married. They were both quite tall and looked something alike in their facial features. Allison wore a natural hair wig. It was a thick blonde hood around her face. She was dressed in bright dyed denims today. She wore durable clothes, usually, for she volunteered afternoons at a children's daycare center. She put one of the smaller pumpkins on Clark's long lap. "Now, nothing surreal," she told him. "Carve just a regular face. These are for the kids." In the foyer, on the Hipplewhite desk, Allison found the maid's chore list with its cross-offs, which included Clark's supper. Allison went quickly through the Daily Mail, a garish coupon packet, a bill from Jamestown Liquors, November's pay TV program guide, and the worst thing, the funniest, an already opened, extremely unkind letter from Clark's relations up north. "You're an old fool," Allison read, "and you're being cruelly deceived." There was a gift check for Clark enclosed, but it was uncashable, signed as it was, Jesus H. Christ. Late, late into this night, Allison and Clark gutted and carved the pumpkins together. at an old table set on the back porch, over newspaper after soggy newspaper with paring knives and with spoons and with a Swiss Army knife Clark used for exact shaping of tooth and eye and nostril. Clark had been a doctor, an internist, but also a Sunday watercolorist. His four pumpkins were expressive and artful. Their carved features were suited to the sizes and shapes of the pumpkins. Two looked ferocious and jagged. One registered surprise. The last was serene and beaming. Allison's four faces were less deftly drawn, with slits and areas of distortion. She had cut triangles for noses and eyes. The mouths she had made were just wedges, two turned up and two turned down. By 1 in the morning, they were finished. Clark, who had bent his long torso forward to work, moved back over to the glider and looked out sleepily at nothing. All the lights were out across the ravine. Clark stayed. For the season and time, the Virginia night was warm. Most leaves had been blown away already, and the trees stood unbothered. The moon was round above them. Allison cleaned up the mess. "Your jack-o'-lanterns are much, much better than mine," Clark said to her. "Like hell," Allison said. "Look at me," Clark said. Allison did. She was holding a squishy bundle of newspapers. The papers reeked sweetly with the smell of pumpkin guts. "Yours are far better," he said. "You're wrong. You'll see when they're lit," Allison said. She went inside and came back with yellow vigil candles. It took her a while to get each candle settled, and then to line up the results in a row on the porch railing. She went along and lit each candle and fixed the pumpkin lids over the little flames. "See," she said. They sat together a moment and looked at the orange faces. "We're exhausted." "It's good night time," Allison said. "Don't blow out the candles. I'll put new ones in tomorrow." That night, in their bedroom, a few weeks earlier than had been predicted, Allison began to die. "Don't look at me if my wig comes off," she told Clark. "Please." Her pulse cords were fluttering under his fingers. She raised her knees and kicked away the comforter. She said something to Clark about the garage being locked. At the telephone, Clark had a clear view out back and down to the porch. He wanted to get drunk with his wife once more. He wanted to tell her, from the greater perspective he had, that to own only a little talent, like his, was an awful, plaguing thing. That being only a little special meant you expected too much most of the time and liked yourself too little. He wanted to assure her that she had missed nothing. He was speaking into the phone now. He watched the jack-o'-lanterns. The jack-o'-lanterns watched him. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Take care.
And good night.
Keep the spirits at bay and hand out the full-size candy bars if you can. That's really special.
These are for the kids.
Please, nobody email us with ghost stories.
Are you kidding? I love ghost stories.
No, I don't.
Email me everybody, with ghost stories.
I have to read the emails first.
Oh, yeah, that's true.